thanks for the invitation to give a talk. Would have been great to also come to see you at Perimeter, but okay, maybe there'll be another opportunity probably more normal times. So I'm going to talk about work that was done in collaboration with Kevin, who's currently at King's College in London, and that's based on these two papers. So although, because of time constraints, I will mostly be talking about that work, maybe just comment on this work in the very end. Okay, so just as a motivation, it's been realized over the past couple of years that the infrastructure of gravity in asymptotically flat space times is remarkably rich. So if we look at gravity at large distances, very long time scales, and very low energies, there are a lot of surprises there. And this is not really new. It has been actually known since the 60s, since the work of Bondi, van der Burg, Metz, and Sachs. But over the past years, people come to realize that there are more insights to be gained, more to learn from the infrared behavior of gravity, and so also that there are still many surprises waiting. So what did Bondi, van der Burg, Metz, and Sachs actually? What did they find? Just to set the stage, they were interested in looking at gravitational processes where you have some matter interacting gravitationally somewhere in the bulk, but then far away from this gravitational process, the space-time should look almost like Minkowski space. So you have some notion of null infinity, just as in Minkowski space, and you can have gravitational radiation reach null infinity. So this, and they wrote down boundary conditions for what the for these so-called asymptotically flat space-times at null infinity. Okay, having written down these boundary conditions, you can ask the question, what are the killing vectors that leave this set of metrics invariant up to small corrections? So corrections that basically die down, up to small corrections in the radius. So we are interested in a set of asymptotic symmetries of asymptotically flat space times. Now you can naively expect that, so you can say, okay, the space time out here looks almost like Minkowski space. So probably it will also have the symmetries of Minkowski space. So these spaces will have the symmetries of Minkowski space, which means that we will have the Poincaré group consisting of the Lorentz part, SO3,1, and the four translations. Remarkably, this is not what BMS found. Instead, they found an infinite dimensional symmetry group. So they still found this SO3,1 part, but instead of having only four translations, you have now an infinite number of commuting symmetry generators, so-called super translations. And the translations are parameterized by four numbers. Super translations are parameterized by full function on the sphere. So this surprising result has an immediate number of, as a number of immediate consequences. So you can ask the question, what is the vacuum of gravity, of asymptotically flat gravity? And the vacuum should be arguably Minkowski space. But Minkowski space is only invariant under the Poincaré group, so only invariant under 10 symmetry generators and not under this infinite dimensional group, which means that you have a spontaneous symmetry breaking. So as always, if the vacuum is not invariant under the full symmetry group of the theory, there's spontaneous symmetry breaking. And you also have an infinite vacuum degeneracy, and these different vacua are related by the action of the supertranslation. This was very nicely discussed and described in these two papers by Jaroch and Ashtikam. Okay, so yeah, this has been known for some time, but as I said, in the last couple of years, there are things that we've learned that can be understood in terms of the symmetry group, for instance, there's the so-called gravitational memory effect, which is if you look at two detectors moving on inertial world lines, then if a gravitational wave passes through between them, they will start to jiggle. But then in the end, there will be a constant offset after the gravitational wave has passed through. And this is the so-called gravitational memory effect. It was shown by Strominger and Shapovalov that this can be understood precisely as this kind of vacuum transition between these degenerate supertranslation vacuum I mentioned above. Furthermore, and perhaps even more surprising, is the fact that if you think about, if you want the gravitational S matrix to be BMS invariant, it turns out that this is equivalent, so this requirement is equivalent to Weinberg's soft graviton theorem. And it was also just that Weinberg proved back in the 60s based only on Feynman diagrams. This was found by these authors here. So you have these IR phenomena here, and it seems that they're all tied together by the vacuum structure and by BMS symmetries. Okay, so it looks like so you have these rich vacuum structure of asymptotically flat gravity, and perhaps there's even more hiding there. There's even more to be learned. So one thing you can try is you can ask the question, perhaps the boundary conditions that Bondi, Van der Burg, Metz, and Sachs imposed are too strict. Maybe let's look at looser boundary conditions and see whether we can see whether there's something to be learned from this. Okay, so let's have a look again at the BMS group. If you look at that part, this is the Lorentz group. And the Lorentz group can also be understood as the global conformal transformations of the two sphere, which is a very natural point of view in this, in the context of asymptotic symmetries. So what about we just drop the assumption of along the globally well-defined transformations, but also allow locally well-defined transformations. Also allow local transformations. And what happens then is that the Lorentz part gets uplifted to another infinite dimensional symmetry group, which is two copies. So you get two times on an infinitesimal level, two times Spierozauer algebra. And these are the so-called super rotations. They were for the first time defined by Barnish and Froissart in 2011. And indeed, just as before, you can also find that there are also soft theorems that are arguably related to this extended BMS group. Right, but okay, so the question has not been settled yet. What are the good boundary conditions for asymptotically flat spacetimes? So it has been argued that perhaps we should uplift this Virasoro, the two copies of the Virasoro algebra, to the full diffeomorphism group of the two sphere. This is called the generalized BMS group. Or you can even include an additional symmetry that acts like a Weyl scale on the boundary. That was, for instance, also proposed by Barnish and Lambert, and by these authors, some of which might be in the audience. In any case, the vacuum is even more degenerate if you include the symmetric transformations. So you have these very complicated, highly degenerate vacuum structure of asymptotically flat gravity. Okay, so what are we going to do in this talk? We're going to identify a subsector of GR that basically picks out precisely the radiative vacua at Sky. So the space-times where no, without gravitational flux going out to non-infinity. And we'll be able to write this as a theory that lives only on Sky. So this will be the first two parts of the talk. So in the first part, I will define what I mean by asymptotically flat spacetimes. And in the second part, I will then define what I mean by these radiative vacua. And I will tell you how to reformulate this in terms of a theory living only on Sky. Right, but so in the there's a third part, and here we're going to show that under some assumptions, we'll be able to reduce this three-dimensional theory living on Scribe further to a two-dimensional conformal field theory living on the boundary of Scribe. And so it turned out we had to form the constrained Western Inuit model. So this slide is basically the gist of the talk, and I will go now through all of these points. Okay, so let's start with the bulk perspective, just asymptotically flat gravity in Riemann integration. Okay, so this is the metric in Neumann integrage. So Neumann integrage is defined by saying that surfaces of constant U, we introduce coordinate U on Scribe, surfaces of constant U should be light-like, and R should be a fine parameter on these light-like surfaces. And these light-like geodesics are labeled by two coordinates, xi. So you can think of these coordinates xi as being labeling cuts of Scribe. Okay, and these are the boundary conditions we will impose, just in the metric formulation. Although it turns out that it would be, for our setup, would be better to work in a first order formulation. So we'll introduce four tetrads, EU hat, ER hat, and two other spatial tetrads, EA. And the tangent space metric will look like this. So these are almost, this is like a null tetrad, although we chose to normalize the spatial parts like this. Okay. Now, this is the slide. So here are the boundary conditions for these tetrads in Neumann integrage. And so probably it's not very illuminating to stare at these formulas for a long time. I just wanted to highlight the important fields. So we make an expansion in R. All of these fields are R independent. And these fields, this field, for instance, mu ranges over u and the two coordinate xi. So those fields have no lag in the R direction, right? And so we have this leading fields H mu and E mu coming from the tetrad. And then we also have the spin connection. And in the spin connection, we also define two fields, omega and BA. All of the other components of the spin connection are either zero or can be determined in terms of these fields. Okay, so I tried to do some color coding. So the green part are these fields coming from the leading fields coming from the tetrad. Blue fields are the fields coming from the spin connection. Okay, in addition to this, there are also a couple of other boundary conditions we have to impose. So for instance, this guy here, you can think of this as a Zweibein on a constant U slice on null infinity. This is being a Zweibein, but it has three legs, so there will be, those won't be linearly independent. So we're going to set one of the coordinates to zero, one of the legs to zero. So the EA has no, it's degenerate in the U direction. Furthermore, out of the EAs, we can build a metric. And we assume that this metric has the following form. There's a conformal factor in front that can be U dependent, and then a metric on the two sphere that has a fixed determinant. Okay, so these are our boundary conditions. Einstein's equations in this first order formulation would now tell you to first solve the torsion constraint for omega, and then plug omega into Einstein's equation, given some meta content. And the way you do this is you solve this order by order. So first to leading order, you will get some relations between those leading order fields. And then having solved those, you can solve for the subleading order fields and so on. So you can solve Einstein's equations order by order. Okay. Now having defined our boundary condition, we're gonna ask the same question that BMS asked: what are the asymptotic symmetries? So we are working in the first order formulation. So we're going to have diffeomorphisms and local Lorentz transformations. Right, and it turns out for the local Lorentz transformations, the symmetries we're allowed to do is the following: we can rotate the spatial field here by the spatial zweibinds into one another. And we can always do a null rotation around one of the light-like vectors that will turn H into E into the zweibinds, basically. These are the local Lorentz transformations. And on top of them, we have the diffeomorphisms. And there we find super translations, if there's two super rotations, and Y transformations. Okay, so now there are various paths you can take now depending on what you're interested in. For instance, you could study the question, suppose I'm starting with Minkowski space, and I'm acting with these finite diffeomorphisms, with the finite asymptotic symmetries, and then I will generate the orbit of the asymptotic of Minkowski space under these asymptotic symmetries. Another thing you can do is, of course, you can solve Einstein's equations, as I said before, just in a power series expansion, but this is not what we're going to do. Rather, as I said before, we'll be interested in imposing further conditions on the field expansion, on these fields that we have in our expansion, such that we get radiative vacua at null infinity. And this will be the second part of my talk. Yeah, of course, please interrupt me if you have any questions at any point. Okay. Now, what do we mean by radiative vacua of asymptotically flat spacetimes? So we're going to impose a couple of conditions. The first condition we're going to impose is that we want the torsion constraint to hold to leading order. So you remember the torsion constraint was one of the two Einstein equations, if you wish, in the first order formulation. And we just want the torsion constraint to hold to leading order. This is a very mild assumption. If you want to solve Einstein's equations, this is what you have to do anyways. So, and we will obtain these two equations from the torsion constraint. So we should think of these equations. You remember mu, so all of these fields at a mu index, which means that these are three-dimensional fields essentially. And this should be understood as a three-dimensional equation. So yeah, if you wanted, we could write this out in this way, where all of the indices run from u, take the values u and xi. Okay, so we get this set of three-dimensional equations. Another condition we're going to impose is we want the scalar curvature to vanish like r to the minus two. Again, if you were to solve the Einstein equations for, let's say, no matter, then this would be zero. So this is again an equation that you would have to impose anyway. Or also for most matter contents, the scalar curvature vanishes like r to the minus three or minus four, I guess. So this is still a very reasonable assumption. And doing this, we get another equation. Okay, so these two conditions were very mild. And now here comes the important part. As I said, we don't want to have any radiation outgoing to scry. And the way we're going to impose this is that we say that the leading magnetic wild tensor should be zero. So the wild tensor knows about gravitational radiation in the sense that if you have a stationary spacetime, the magnetic wild tensor vanishes. And right, so this is the condition we're going to impose, that we have a stationary spacetime essentially, and you get another condition on our fields. So you see we have now six equations that our leading order fields have to solve. Okay. So now let's put this aside for a moment and think about the following. Consider this an algebra generated by six generators that I called H, P, B, and J, and that obey this algebra. The color coding should be, of course, reminiscent of what I told you before, but this will become more obvious in a minute. And so this algebra, you can see, for instance, that J acts, rotates fields, basically generates spatial rotations. So J rotates the P's into one another, and similar for the B. H, on the other hand, acts somewhat like a conformal transformation. Now this algebra, as I said, it has six generators, and it turns out that this algebra is actually SO3,1, the Lorentz algebra, just written in a probably unconventional basis. Okay, and now let's just define the following field. Let's define a gauge field, a three-dimensional gauge field. So again, it has a mu index running, introducing some coordinates. Mu runs over u, x, index I. And this gauge field is SO3,1 value. So with the field PA, I associate a field that I call EA. And with the field J, for instance, I associate a field that I call omega. Of course, the naming is not coincidental. Okay, so one way to see why this is so basically this split of the algebra is interesting to look at is the following. The algebra generated by the blue generators is ISO2. And so you can think now about the homogeneous space you get when you quotient SO3,1 by the algebra generated by the blue guys. So SO3,1 quotiented by ISO2. It turns out that this is the light cone of Minkowski space, just viewed as a three-dimensional space-time on its own. If you're not so familiar with this, you can think of in the same way about Minkowski space. So Minkowski space, there's a nice action of the Poincaré group on Minkowski space. And we can quotient now, if we quotient this 10-dimensional group by a six-dimensional subgroup, the subgroup being, of course, the Lorentz group, which we interpret as the internal symmetry transformations, then we're left with a four-dimensional space-time, which is Minkowski space. And we're doing precisely the same thing here with the Lorentz group, only that we're quotienting by the subgroup ISO2. And right, this makes sense to consider, as I said before, J transforms the P's into one another. So you can think of J as like an internal transformation. Okay. Now, having written down this gauge field, the first thing you want to do is to calculate this field strength. And if you calculate the field strength, it turns out, maybe not so surprisingly, just by the way I've constructed it, that these are precisely the six equations we had before the radiative vacuum conditions are imposed to. So these six equations, all of them can be reproduced by the vanishing field strength of this gauge field. Okay, so right, we have now a gauge theoretic formulation of these radiative vacuum conditions in terms of the vanishing of some field strength of an SO3 comma 1 fluid. Yeah, yes, please.
Hello, Jacob. Yeah, I have a question. So the vanishing there is because you have emitted no radiation, correct?
Sorry, again?
The vanishing of the curvature.
Yeah.
Because right. You have emitted no radiation.
Precisely, yeah. Precisely.
Okay. So yeah. There's presumably an equation that generalizes that in terms of radiation, or it cannot simply be written as a curvature condition?
I'm not sure whether it can be written as a curvature condition. So what you would want is basically some source term here on the right-hand side of that equation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think that you can write it as a vanishing of some curvature.
Can you say a bit more about the interplay between this SL2C algebra that you have and the super rotation algebra?
I'll come to that in a minute.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, so we've written down just on the level of equations of motions these radiative vacuum conditions as the vanishing of the field strength. But so let's do a bit more. These are three-dimensional. These equations are defined on a three-dimensional manifold. And there is a very natural three-dimensional theory you can write down that yields these equations of motions. And that's the Chern-Simons theory. So let's just assume that we have a Chern-Simons theory, an SO3,1 value Chern-Simons theory on scribe. And okay, as I said, if I vary this action, I obtain the equation of motion F equals zero, which are precisely the radiative vacuum conditions. But there's more to that, namely, the Chern-Simons theory is invariant under these symmetry transformations, where lambda is an arbitrary SO3,1 valued function. And these symmetry transformations correspond precisely to the set of asymptotic symmetries we had before. So you remember we had the rotation, the Zweibein rotation, we had this null rotation, we had a Weyl rescaling, and we had the super rotations. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the generators of these symmetries and the asymptotic symmetries we had before. In particular, it turns out that if I write this generator here, if I expand it again in terms of my the generators of my Lie algebra will be a guy that is the coefficient of PA. And these turn out to be precisely the difference to super rotations. So we got a one-to-one map between asymptotic symmetries and gauge truffles, gauge transformations of the Chern-Simons theory. The only thing we didn't get are the super translations. So super translations are not included. We cannot describe different super translation vector by this Chern-Simons theory. So probably somewhere along the way we've singled out the super translation frame.
Well, I think you should say that it's because the shear is not part of the fields that we're keeping.
Yeah, right. Thanks, Kevin. So as I said, the Chern-Simons theory can only describe these leading order fields. The information about super translations, although, is kept in the subleading order field. And this is not other people can capture. Okay, hold on. Yeah. So this ends the second part of my talk. We imposed some conditions on our fields in Newman Unti gauge, such that we're singling out only the space times where no radiation goes out to sky. And we found that that these conditions are described as six equations, and we can reproduce these equations by a transimence theory on sky. And indeed, the asymptotic symmetries, the symmetries of both sides match in the sense that the asymptotic symmetries of Newman-Unti gauge and the symmetries of the transimence theory are in one-to-one correspondence, except for the supertranslation. Okay, so far so good. But we've been basically working on the level of equations of motion and symmetries all the time. But let's make a leap of faith and take this transcendence theory more seriously. And then we'll be able to do a bit more. Transcendence theories are topological, which means that all the non-trivial information actually resides on the boundary of the theory. And there's a well-known procedure how you can, so given a transcendence theory based on some gauge group G, you can obtain a two-dimensional CFT. In particular, you can get a Westermeier-Witten model on the boundary of the manifold that transcendence theory is defined on. So given a transcendence theory with gauge group G, you will get a Westermeier-Witten model also based on a gauge group G. However, there's a subtlety that you have to take into account, namely, if you impose boundary conditions on the fields of the transcendence theory, these boundary conditions will impose constraints on the Westermeier-Witten model on the boundary. So suppose we have a three-dimensional manifold like Scry in our example, and we impose boundary conditions of our fields, in this case near Scry plus minus, then we will get a constrained Westermeier-Witten model there. So just in case you're familiar with this, this is a well-known procedure from 3D gravity in anti-de Sitter spacetimes, for instance. You might know that you can describe 3D gravity just in terms of a transcendence theory in three dimensions. And you can reduce the theory to the boundary, you get a Westermeier-Witten model, but then you have to still impose the conditions so asymptotically ADS boundary conditions. And by this, you will reduce the Westermeier-Witten model to a Liouville theory. This goes back to a seminal paper by Cusseri, Moreau, and Van Rie. And in the last couple of years, this has been revisited and also refined. Okay, here's a caveat. I've sidestepped the question until now, but now is probably the time to address it. The global properties of the superrotation vacuum, they're not really well understood. There have been proposals that they, if I have Minkowski space and act with a finite superrotation, that I generate a string in the bulk, so a cosmic string in the bulk, an angular deficit. Or it has been also proposed by maybe some people in the audience here that instead what you should do so that you don't get scry with where the spatial sizes have the topology of an S2, but rather you get punctures on scry. So it's not really clear how to think about the global properties of scry. But of course, the transcendence theory should should know about this. The transformation theory is a topological theory, so basically all it knows about is the topology and the boundary conditions. And just to make some progress, we're going to assume that the transformation theory lives on a scry that is of the topology R times S2. Okay, so how do we proceed now? So this is just two slides how the Hamiltonian reduction works. I write my transformation theory in Hamiltonian form. So I introduced three coordinates on my three-dimensional manifold U that I called U, Z, and Z bar. If you write the theory, if you write transformation theory in a Hamiltonian form, you find that the field, one of the fields, in this case A Z bar, appears only as a Lagrange multiplier for a constraint. So if you vary the action with respect to A Z bar, you know, you see that A F, this F should be zero. We can easily solve this constraint. This constraint just tells us that A U and A Z are pure gauge in the sense that we can write them in terms of a group element of SLP. Okay, you take these solutions, plug them back into the action, and what you get is, as I mentioned before, the SL3,1 Westermino Whitney ball that lives on the boundary of scry. In the following, so clearly scry having the topology of RS2, according to our assumption, has two boundaries, one near I plus and one near I naught. And again, just for simplicity, we're going to focus on one of the boundaries only, in this case, on the boundary near I naught. Okay, so that's basically, that's the first part I told you. So if you have a transformation theory, you can reduce it to a Westermino-Witt model on the boundary. But there are still boundary conditions you have to take into account. For instance, just from our gravity analysis, if you remember, I said that these Zweibeins, they should be degenerate into in one of the three-dimensional, in one of the directions of scry. And this was actually true. We imposed this condition everywhere near scry. So in particular, it should be also true here in the vicinity of I naught. So this is one of the conditions. Similarly, this is another condition we imposed before. So we imposed these boundary conditions at the lower boundary of scry plus, just in order to be compatible with our 4D gravity analysis. But here's another condition that we have to that we imposed, namely the following: the metric that we construct out of these Zweibeins should, close to scry plus minus, should be of that form. So we want it to be the metric on the two sphere times a conformal factor. And so the conformal factor is arbitrary but fixed. This is of course a strong assumption. Not any metric we could think of can be brought into this form. So this clearly restricts the class of metrics that are allowed, that we allow near scry plus minus. And when I say metrics, I mean, of course, the conformal, the two-dimensional metric on one of these slices. Okay, so how does this work? So from these boundary conditions, so for instance, we have, I told you before that AU is pure gauge. Now, if we parameterize our group element in this form, just as a, so as exponentials of the generators of the group of the algebra, then we find, for instance, that this boundary condition tells us that these guys here should be U independent. And similarly, all the other boundary conditions, what they tell you is that all of these fields can actually be algebraically expressed only in terms of this guy here. But as you might remember from before, these guys are actually correspond to super rotations. And since this was on the level of the algebra, but now working on the level of the group, these are actually correspond to finite super rotations. Okay, so we had this two-dimensional Western-Witten model. We solved these constraints implied by these boundary conditions in the square plus minus. And what we get then is this action. See, it depends only on the field pi, where we define pi. So we, in this case, we use the complex field, just explicitly, because it makes things much easier. So we have a pi that's built out of the pi a's I before, pi bar. And this action is the so-called Alexeyev-Shvatashvili action. And but in this case, since the fields describes our super rotation modes, this is, we call this the effective action of super rotation modes. This is a two-dimensional action, living on an S2 that we can think of being at square plus minus. What are the equations of motion? Let's define an object T, which is basically just the Schwarzian derivative. And the equations of motion tell us that this T depends only on Z. And this implies that the solutions of this Alexeyev-Shvatashvili action are such that pi depends only on Z and pi bar depends only on Z bar. Okay, so these are the solutions. This action has a nice, has very nice symmetries. In fact, it has an infinite number of symmetries. And the symmetries are charges that look like this. So for any choice of epsilon, there's a charge. These charges under the Poisson bracket form a Virasoro algebra. So the solutions, which just tells us that these guys here correspond well in the, or it implies, as we'll see in a minute, that these guys will correspond to the Virasoro super rotation back here, or will generate Virasoro super rotation back here for the four-dimensional metric. In addition to these symmetries, we also have a gauge symmetry. This is just S of 3,1. So all of these pi's are actually only defined up to a finite Lorentz transformation. Okay. And now we can translate the results back into the 4D gravity formulation. We take the solutions of this action. As I said, they are defined by pi's that depend only on Z or Z bar. We plug this back into the gauge field that we had before. And then from the gauge field, we translate this back into the metric. And what we end up with after some simplifications, setting some fields to zero, some pure gauge fields, we end up with this metric. So you see it's leading order Minkowski space, but then there's a subleading part. And the subleading part, this field C, the shear, if you wish, contains is made out of two components. One is precisely this, the Schwarzian derivative we had before, which determines the super rotation vacuum. So given a solution of this effective action of super rotation mode, you get a super rotation vacuum in the bulk. But due to the, since these pi's are only defined up to a finite Lorentz transformation, so these pi's are only defined up to a finite Lorentz transformation, which of course makes sense as those should be symmetries, still symmetries of the bulk. So and then there's another piece, which would a U-independent piece, which would determine the supertranslation vacuum. But as I said before, we don't have access to the supertranslations in our framework, so we're not able to determine the supertranslation vacuum. So in summary, the effective action of superrotation modes, using this, we can reproduce the vacuum configurations that were constructed before by these authors. And what it shows, maybe I should mention this, you can see, so this action, you can see the spontaneous symmetry breaking in the sense that this action, that the pi's, the solutions, pi of z, are zero modes of this action. So if you choose all of this, there's no way to distinguish by, let's say, the on-shot value of this action for, between different superrotation configurations, Virasoro superrotation configurations. However, an arbitrary diff S2, arbitrary diff S2 superrotation, where pi is a function of z and z bar, this is not a zero direction of this action. So it's not a classical solution, but it's also not, it has a finite action. So this action, in this sense, this action describes an explicit breaking of diff S2 superrotations to the Virasoro superrotation and a spontaneous symmetry breaking from Virasoro to SO3,1, the Lorentz group. Okay, so this was actually the end of my talk. Just to summarize, we found that the leading order fields in Neumann-Unti gauge, or in this perhaps slightly generalized Neumann-Unti gauge, they obey the equations of an SO3,1 John Simon theory, assuming that we have no outgoing gravitational radiation. And given some assumption of the fall of behavior of our fields close to square plus minus, we obtain an Alexeyev-Shatashvili action on the boundary of square. So using our assumption that square has a topology of R times S2, we get an Alexeyev-Shatashvili action on the sphere. This Alexeyev-Shatashvili action is an effective 2D description of our superrotation vacuum. So this was a summary and just two questions that, that would be interesting to answer in this framework is, there's been some interest in reformulating scattering of fields on asymptotically flat spacetimes in terms of a CFT of some putative celestial CFT that is defined on a sphere on a sphere, Euclidean sphere. And so the question is whether how what I presented here fits into this framework. So does this Alexeyev-Shatashvili action really describe some subsect of this celestial CFT? It's not clear until now. Furthermore, of course, would be interesting to better understand the role played by these different superrotation vacua and how to think about them in a sense. So, as I said, we assumed that the topology of Scry is R times S2, but this is of course not true if you think about Virasoro superrotations. So clearly a better understanding of superrotation vacua is needed if we want to make this more precise or what I just presented. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Jakob, for this very nice talk. Are there questions first from students? So it seems like at the moment there are no questions from students. So questions from anyone else?
I have a question.
Okay, Mark.
Yes. Thanks, Jakob, for the really nice talk. Interesting. Sure. I was wondering if there would be any if there's any meaning to the surface charges of this 3D transcendence theory. So the 1D charges that I'm not sure where they would live and what they would mean.
Right. So yeah, we haven't really looked at this, but I suppose they should be related to those guys. Somehow you should find these surface charges living on an S2. So these are the charges you obtain from this effective action and mm-hmm. the generative Virzoro algebra. Right. So I suppose the surface charges of the transcendence theory should somehow reproduce those guys.
Mm-hmm. But shouldn't they live on a 1D manifold somehow?
Yeah, right. I mean, this guy actually, I mean, it's just 1D integral. So it just.
Yes, I was looking. Yes, thanks.
And this is, of course, the charges of the transcendence theory depend, of course, on the boundary condition we impose.
Yes.
So here we impose these boundary conditions on the sphere. And we got those. So basically, the only thing that survives is the Virasoro algebra.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there are. I suppose there are smarter things to do. Yeah.
So next, there is a question by Laurent.
Hello, Jacob. Thank you for your talk.
Yeah, sure. Thanks.
Very nice. I have several questions. One question is about you mentioned that at the end, some of the tension, the discussion around the super rotation as Virasoro versus Diff. S2. So one question is that, extended or generalized, is it that this John Simon's description doesn't go through for Diff S, or is there a challenge there, or what's the...
I think the...
What's the story?
So just on the level of the transcendence theory, so in the gravity description, we found the symmetries that and a full diff S2. Mm-hmm. Our boundary conditions were such that we found the diff S2. And as I said, there was these are also we can translate them to the gauge, to the symmetries of the transcendence theory are precisely the same. So the transcendence theory itself, the gauge symmetry of the transcendence theory include also diff S2.
Mm-hmm.
The point where we break the diff S2 is when we're doing this reduction. And that's precisely because of this boundary condition.
Mm-hmm.
So when we impose this boundary, so we're saying that the close to scribe plus minus, close to I naught, this 2D metric should be of this form. But of course, not, as I said, not every metric can be brought into this form. So what basically singles out why this still allows for Virasoro transformations that you do a diffeomorphism. So you allow for these diffeomorphisms that just rescale the metric by a conformal factor, and then you act with another generator, basically reduces again, that kills the conformal factor you just generated. So by assuming this, we single out the Virasoro as the real kind of physical transformations we ascribe as minus. But yeah, would be interesting whether you can lift this and get a theory that is basically diff S2 in there.
Okay, that contains here more usually with the charges that generalize this.
Right.
T as being the charge. Maybe I don't know, there's nobody else. I have two more questions, but I don't want to give anyone.
I mean, we have okay.
Go ahead. For now, I don't see other raised hands. But if anyone has a question, please raise your hand. In the meantime, Laurent, go ahead.
Well, can I get in before the two?
Okay, others? Then Anthony, yes.
I just had a question of what was the reason for doing Newman-Unti? Just because, yeah, in this work where we were looking at the finite super rotations, the Newman-Unti gauge kind of just behaves a lot differently than the Bondi gauge if you're really interested in like how it's approaching Scry. So I'm just curious, why would you use Newman-Unti, and do you have any idea like the fact that it kind of develops caustics quite easily when you have these singular super rotations, that means anything in the Chern-Simons theory or something like that? Or
just my answer is basically just on a technical level, in the sense that I think we tried with Bondi gauge and it just turned out to be much easier than Bondi gauge.
So it didn't work. Okay.
In fact, we rediscovered the Newman-Unti gauge by doing this work.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was not the starting point, but we ended up like rederiving all the Newman-Unti conditions.
Right. Right. Yeah. So. And so the questions you said about these caustics and the global properties of Scry, unfortunately, I think I don't have anything to say about that. All the analysis we did was basically only on a local level. We didn't really care about the topology. There's probably.
You have this like Wessimino-Witten description, there must be something. I don't really know much about that, but they must do something with defects in those.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, I can point you to the right. So sorry, I think I didn't. If we had a defect somewhere, if I solve this constraint. I wrote it just like G minus one DUG. But in principle, we could have holonomies. So if I have a defect, I would have a holonomy somewhere. Mm-hmm. I can wrap around my gate field around the defect. And then this would mean that either G is not single valued, or that, for instance, I write G minus one DUG plus there's another term basically that parameterizes the holonomy. And this is exactly the point where where having defects would change the Wessimino-Witten model or Xavier-Shuttle free reaction on the boundary.
Hmm.
Yeah. But the point is somehow, and that's where we got confused, is that these defects actually depend on the super rotation that you're acting on with, right? I mean, so the defect depends on, if I act with the super rotation, the Z to the alpha, the defect depends on alpha. And that's the reason we decided to just assume that our topology is trivial.
Yeah, thanks.
Sure. Thanks for the question.
Okay, are there questions from people who have not spoken so far? Okay, doesn't seem to be the case. And
Laurent,
go ahead.
I have a question about, can you go back to this asymptotic formula you had for C? So the vacua solution, I have a question about the comparison with the work of Campere. So first T here is the Schwarzschild derivative of pi, right? That's what you're showing in the previous slide. Yeah, it's here. So in the work of Compare, and I guess, it goes back to Gerock, right? This T is the ZZ component of the Gerock tensor, or the Liouville stress tensor, right? And in the work of Compare, what's interesting is that he writes this T as a functional of the boundary metric Q. So the fact that this T for you satisfy, this Virasoro algebra suggests therefore that the boundary metric is non-commutative, is that, or how do you reconcile these two versions of T? T is the Gerock tensor, that is, which is a functional of the of QAB, and T is the generator of Virasoro. You see why I'm asking that?
I actually had a slide where I wanted to show that this field that we have, the field B, is actually the Gerock tensor. So as you said, this is the Gerock tensor, which basically defines your vacuum. Right? So if you want to define a news, you have to strip off the Gerock tensor first. So in the literature, this tensor is usually only defined in a Bondi frame, if I remember correctly. So that's the usual
thing. There's a generalization of Compere Ruzziconi, where maybe that's what, there's this nice paper they wrote in 1810, where they in some sense generalize this notion of a Gerock tensor, which is to the case where you have an arbitrary metric, and there it's a functional of the metric. So it's been studied by Campiglia. So I was referring to that work, and in that case, the Gerock tensor T is really an explicit function. It's a non-local functional, but it's a functional of the boundary metric.
So in this case, they look at the symmetries dip S2, if I remember correctly. Right?
Yes, in the case.
I would suspect if you restrict it to the superrotation, to the Virasoro superrotations, this is what you would find. But I agree, and actually, so Kevin and I, we were talking about this some time ago, that it's a bit curious that this Gerock tensor transforms like on the Virasoro, so that it has this, it looks like the stress tensor of this Westermann-Witt model. This is, we don't have any good interpretation of this, but this is kind of curious.
Just something to add that, so there is one paper by Compère and Long where they have exactly that expression with T being the short-term derivative. And there they describe Virasoro superrotations. They have boundary conditions that are exactly the same ones that Jakob was mentioning, that restrict the boundary metric to be some conformal factor times dz dz bar.
Mm-hmm.
And so that in that paper, they have exactly T as being the Schwarzschild derivative. And then there is this other paper where T is the UV stress tensor. And that's because they allow for more general metrics on the sphere. But if you take the Liouville stress tensor, and that's true. If you take the Liouville stress tensor and then ask that the metric on the sphere is dz dz bar, you get back to this expression.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. So the takeaway message, which is a key of quantum gravity, if I really take that as granted, it means that the Liouville field is just the scale of the boundary metric, and it could be generalized to the full metric for the Liouville stress tensor. But if you're telling me that guy satisfies Virasoro algebra, you're telling me that the metric itself is non-commutative, right? So it's a quantum operator that has a spectra and cannot be completely diagonalized, which is the core, if you want, of all quantum gravity. So would you agree with that conclusion?
I think I'm not sure.
I don't get it. Yeah. To me, it looks pretty much like usual CFT, where you have some fixed background metric and some quantum fields on top of it.
In your presentation, but T comes from, it's a component of, T is a functional of the boundary metric from the 4D point of view, right? So if T is non-commutative, it means that boundary metric or that corner metric is non-commutative, which is a pretty dramatic, which is a very interesting statement.
But there was this same story in ADS, right? You have this Pfefferman-Gram expansion. At leading order, you have gamma, so the induced metric. At subleading order, you have T, the stress tensor. But those two are when, so again, yeah, when you restrict yourself to.
Yeah, here is different because T is the leading order. So it's the metric. It's not the, the subleading, it's C, which does not commute. It's okay. But T is really the background metric, the functional background metric, which usually, yeah.
It appears at sub. So,
right. So
it I would say no, because C, so at leading order, at order R squared, right. Jakob, you're.
So at leading order, at least in the 40, so we're talking about the 40 gravity metric now. Then we still have the flat metric, which is boundary condition we imposed. Which was part of the boundary condition we imposed at square plus minus. But yeah, and this T is then only the subleading order.
I'm using the formula of Comperé. Comperé has an explicit formula of T as a functional of the boundary metric. That's the.
Yeah. In that case,
it is a functional of the boundary metric.
In that case, so I agree that then it looks like if T is a quantum operator, then Q is like the induced metric is also a quantum operator. But if you restrict to Virasoro, there is you don't have that anymore.
No. Maybe it's a good thing. I mean, that's what quantum gravity is about.
Yeah. I don't know.
So I see that there is one more question by Seth.
Mm-hmm. Hello.
Hi.
Okay, so I have maybe a busy question on one of your assumptions. So I saw you assume that where you considered no radiation at square plus fictional infinity, and you said it's kind of equivalent to that the curvature of the connection is zero, it's flat basically. But maybe my question is more like, why do you assume this? Is there a physical reason behind this?
Why we assume that there's no radiation outgoing?
Yeah.
So, right, we're interested in kind of an effective description of a subset of GR. So this is basically our assumption that we only want to describe the sector of GR where there's no radiation outgoing. That's correct. So we basically want only to describe, we want to get a theory that only describes the vacuum sector of GR. But this is the reason that we impose this condition, just because we want to have a description of the subsector.
But then in the beginning you said the vacuum is degenerate, so which vacuum are you referring to?
As we see here, although we have no outgoing radiation, we have still different vacua that are related by super rotate by these symmetries. So yeah. I can start with Minkowski space. Mm-hmm. This Minkowski space in whatever coordinates you like. These Newman anti coordinates, and then I act with a symmetry, with a finite symmetry transformation on Minkowski space, and I obtain another solution of GR, which is still, there's still no radiation outgoing. It's still flat because it was acted with a diffeomorphism. So you could say it's another vacuum. So there are infinitely many vacuum, although this restriction is very strong, there's no radiation outgoing, there's still infinitely many solutions that we can describe.
I see, yeah, thanks.
Sure, thanks.
William?
Hey.
Hi.
Thank you for your talk. If I understand, you derived this action sort of by backing in from the equation of motion, right? So you use this flatness constraint and derive Trin-Simons from it. Sort of maybe what I would have expected to do, and something that people have done before, is to just write down, say, a solution corresponding to the super rotated Minkowski space, like the things that Antony and Victor and Eugene and I wrote down. And then just evaluating the action on that solution with appropriate boundary terms and so on. Did you think about this approach? Do you think it would be equivalent? Is there, you know,
we what's thought the... of yeah, so definitely, I think that's what you would like to do ideally is to start with a well-defined variational principle for Einstein gravity, and then you restrict somehow to this subsector of the solutions you just mentioned, and somehow you should be able to derive the transcendence theory on the boundary. Unfortunately, I think it's a bit hard to find it. So if you want to start from a well-defined variational principle at SCRI Einstein gravity with a well-defined variational principle at SCRI.
That's right, yeah. So they're like special terms that you have to add at null boundaries. Exactly,
yeah. Yeah, so that seemed like a hard question. And right, but in principle, of course, this is the way you, that's what you wanted to do in principle. I think that would be the ideal way to divide this theory. And related to that, of course, there is this number here. We have this K in front of the action. I never talked about this. This is the coupling constant of the transcendence theory. But since we were only working on the level of equations of motion, there's no way we can, there's no way to determine this. Whereas in the approach you propose, we would be able to derive, to kind of relate this K to probably Newton's constant and then some other dimensional quantities.
Yeah, if there are any kind of non-perturbative effects or anything, then you'd miss them by just having by just knowing the equation of motion. Yeah. You might be able to see something from the full action.
Right. So yeah, this is what people have done in three dimensions. There, it's much easier. But but that's of course something we would be very interested in.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you.
Laurent.
I have a question about initially, because you're in the first order formalism, you had this U1 gauge symmetry rotating the field, but does it play, like it disappears at the end, like you only look at the super rotation sector, but what about the gauge sector? Do you have an extra current algebra in the game? What's the role of this extra?
Right, so these symmetries, let's see where. Yeah, so we had, is this the one you were referring to?
The lambda, yeah, like the pure gauge, the one that in the metric you would not see, right?
Yes.
Is there new information somehow associated with the presence of gauge there?
Yeah.
And current algebras.
I'm not sure. So from the point of view of this transcendence theory, this is these can be all mapped to these SO3,1 gauge symmetries of the transcendence theory, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So this lambda would be just we know actually what it generates. It would basically generate what it would play a similar role as what this J does here. But
I'm asking at the level of the Vesomino-Witten model, right?
Yeah, there
you can activate that as a mode there.
Right, we could. Probably we could do this with different boundary conditions. I'm actually at the moment not precisely sure which boundary condition kills this symmetry.
Okay. Yeah.
But one of them should.
So you're killing it.
Yeah.
So you don't know. You don't know if the K. There's also, if there's an extra current algebra.
One could probably think of looser boundary conditions that still allow for this number.
Mm-hmm. Okay, are there more questions? Okay, so since we still have a few minutes, I would also ask two naive questions. So first, I wanted to ask you, like, how difficult would it be to extend this construction starting from an asymptotically the sitter spacetime, and how would you expect the effective action to change? You are recalling that action, an effective action, but does it really have the same properties of an effective, let's say, the standard effective action of quantum field theory?
So to your first question, for the sitter space, I have to admit I don't know. So I'm probably a bit ignorant about the sitter space. I'm not sure whether you still get in, or what kind of boundary conditions you have to impose in order to get an infinite dimensional symmetry group there. Probably there are such boundary conditions.
In 3D, it's the same, right?
In 3D, you can have boundary conditions that where you get two copies of the Virasoro algebra. In 4D, I'm not sure. To answer your question, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Your second question, I think, so these pies are, I think this is really a kind of nice low energy effective action, in the sense that these pies are the Goldstone modes, if you want, the Goldstone modes of the effect of spontaneously broken super Virasoro super rotations. In the sense that if I pick a pi, I pick out a super rotation vacuum in the bulk. And yeah, so I think in this sense, this action is really like, as you usually learn, if you have some spontaneous symmetry breaking, you can just construct a low energy effective action that just describes the symmetry breaking. And in this sense, I think this action really does this job. So as you see, for instance, all the super rotation vacua are zero modes of this action.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Are there more questions? We have time maybe for one last. Okay, if not, I would ask you all to unmute yourself and thank Jakob for this nice talk and discussion.
Yeah, thanks for the discussion.